news break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Don Waller in New York. George W. Bush ignored the threat of al-Qaeda for months and did too little to stop the September 11th attacks on the United States, a former administration counterterrorism official said Sunday. Richard Clark's accusations, aired in a CBS 60 Minutes interview, drew a detailed point-by-point rebuttal from the White House as it attempted to defend Bush's standing as a presidential candidate who was tough on terrorism. In the program on his book to be launched Monday, Clark charged that Bush had done a terrible job in addressing the threat from terrorism. Former President Jimmy Carter has strongly criticized George Bush and Tony Blair for waging an unnecessary war to oust Saddam Hussein based on lies or misinterpretations. The 2002 Nobel Peace Prize winner said Mr. Blair had allowed his better judgment to be swayed by Mr. Bush's desire to finish a war that his father had started. In an interview with the British newspaper The Independent on the first anniversary of the American and British invasion of Iraq, Carter said the Iraq War was based on lies and misinterpretations from London and from Washington, claiming falsely that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the 9/11 attacks and claiming falsely that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Reports that led to charges against six U.S. soldiers accused of abusing detainees at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison came from within the military, not from prisoner complaints, a senior U.S. military official said Sunday. The soldiers, members of a military police unit, were charged Saturday with a range of crimes including conspiracy, dereliction of duty, cruelty and maltreatment, assault, and indecent acts with another person. The military said about 20 detainees at the prison on the western outskirts of Baghdad were involved. Israel killed Hamas founder Ahmed Yassin in a helicopter missile strike outside a Gaza City mosque Monday, prompting threats of unprecedented revenge by Palestinian militants against Israel and the United States. Yassin was the most prominent Palestinian leader killed by Israel in more than 3 years of fighting, and his assassination was seen as a major escalation. More Minuteman News after this.
I'm Oscar Davis. You may have a serious eye condition and not even know it. Vision loss is not a normal part of aging. Some vision changes are normal. Some are due to eye disease. Do you know the difference? Open your eyes to the facts. To get more information about vision and aging, or find out about what help is available if you're having vision problems, call Lighthouse International at 1-800-829-0500 or visit www.lighthouse.org.
A West Virginia man accused of robbing a convenience store left a big clue behind for investigators, his wallet. Terry Lee Romain of Hansford was charged with robbing the V-Mart in Comfort, West Virginia, Friday morning. He allegedly ordered a slice of pizza and then demanded cash from the clerk, saying he had a gun. As he fled, the clerk looked down and saw the man's wallet on the counter. For the Minuteman News Service, this is Don Waller in New York.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
Have you been chipped yet? A company called Applied Digital Solutions wants you to undergo a surgical procedure to implant a tiny RFID microchip in your arm. Why would you want to do this? Because radio frequency ID chips will eliminate the heavy burden of having to carry credit cards and remember your ATM numbers. Instead, your arm becomes your card and ID number. Simply run your arm under a scanner and your embedded radio chip sends a digital signal to the computer, allowing you to complete your transaction. ADS calls its microchip VeriPay. There's only one rational reason that ADS executives think we'll submit to this. They're insane. Insane, but serious. They insist that this technological leap is needed because many people lose their credit cards. VeriPay solves that problem, says a corporate PR flack, cheerfully noting that ADS's chip is subdermal and very difficult to lose. You don't leave it sitting in the back seat of a taxi, he said. Subdermal or not, your ID number still can be stolen by a geeky thief who rigs up a device to intercept your radio-transmitted number, then plays it back later to your ATM machine, emptying your account. If your number is stolen, or if you simply switch credit card companies or banks, what are you to do? No problem, says the PR guy. If you don't want it anymore, you can go to a doctor and have it removed. I call it an opt-out feature, he said gaily. Swell. Instead of simply calling your credit card company to cancel your card, you'd have to call a surgeon. This is progress. Still, ADS is banking on you to get chipped, as they cheerily put it, even offering a $50 discount to the first 100,000 people who sign up. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, the honchos of ADS are such business geniuses that the company's stock plummeted from $12 a share 3 years ago to about 40 cents today. I wouldn't entrust two bits to them, much less my arm.
What do you know? Someone's at the door. Hello?
Oh, no, a runaway lawnmower. It's going for the shag carpet.
A runaway lawnmower. That's one thing you don't want in your house. One thing you do want in your house is a tougher, more impact-resistant floor with Plitanium plywood from Georgia-Pacific. Plitanium is better at withstanding the occasional dropped bowling ball or frozen turkey than building materials made of wood strands glued together. Plitanium plywood. Build it better.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling?
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, happy Monday. The 22nd of March, 247 days since Valerie Plame was outed by this administration. In their valiant effort to try and keep the story going that there really was a threat from Iraq. You see the show last night, 60 Minutes, with Dick Clark, interestingly named, Richard Clark, the former terrorism czar under Ronald Reagan, George Bush the first, and Bill Clinton and George Bush the second. We're going to get into how much damage have Bush's lies about Iraq done to the war on terror. You know, and I was really reluctant to use the word lies up until very, very recently. I wanted to, you know, give everybody the absolute benefit of the doubt. It looks even as if the situation with Dick Cheney going before the Supreme Court here is something that is soon going to be perhaps revealing one of the real motives for the war in Iraq. I mean, everybody has been around the world. I mean, all of the politicians around the world who, as the president of Poland said, were taken for a ride, their logic was, if there's not a weapon there, if there's not a danger there, if there's not a connection to Al-Qaeda there, then, you know, these guys aren't dumb enough to invade a country that's not a threat to them. Why would they do it?
Because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
And we know now that at the time, what George Bush knew was that in that one place, Iraq gathered 10% of the world's oil. And this is where this case before the Supreme Court is going to be really interesting. Everybody's wondering, why is it that Dick Cheney has gone all the way to the Supreme Court to prevent the records from his April 2001 meetings with oil industry executives in which the American Oil Energy Policy Plan was put together. And, you know, not a lot of people put two and two together until Larry Klayman of Judicial Watch sued Dick Cheney. This is the case where Scalia, after going duck hunting with Cheney, says he's not going to recuse himself, even though the law suggests that the point of recusal is not because you have an actual conflict, but to avoid the appearance of a conflict. Well, Scalia never was one to allow, you know, legal distinctions to anyway. So when Legal Watch got this lawsuit going, they actually got a half a dozen pieces of paper released. before Cheney clamped down, before his lawyers clamped down and said, no, this is going to the Supreme Court. And one of those you can see on Judicial Watch's website, judicialwatch.org. And it's a map of Iraq. Now, this was 6 months before 9/11. It's a map of Iraq, and it lists all of the Iraqi oil fields. And there is a document attached to it, March 2001, that says, and it's titled, and I quote, Foreign Suitors for Iraqi Oil Field Contracts, end quote. Now, it's quite apparent now that that keeping this secret is why Dick Cheney is going to the Supreme Court. And George Bush has been, you know, well, he continues in his speech.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger?
But, you know, wait a minute. Donald Rumsfeld last weekend said nobody ever said there was an imminent threat.
And develops even more dangerous weapons.
Nobody ever said there was an imminent threat. Nobody ever said there was a danger.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents.
Yeah, 15 years earlier, with the assistance of Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush Sr., you know, Dick Cheney was selling equipment to Saddam Hussein during the last years of the Clinton administration. A year before he became vice president, Dick Cheney was still, through Halliburton, was still doing business with Saddam Hussein.
Including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
Although Cheney wasn't selling them the gases, he was selling them oil field equipment.
Iraq possesses ballistic missiles with a likely range of hundreds of miles.
Hundreds.
Far enough to strike Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, and other nations.
Turns out, a
region where more than 135,000 American civilians and service members live and work.
Well, it turns out that those missiles weren't there, but that wasn't half of it, said George.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles.
Remember that? We found one balsa wood model airplane that couldn't fly more than 100 feet.
To be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
Yeah, we're going to get a model airplane targeting the United States. No, Rumsfeld said, we never said there was an imminent threat. 18 minutes past the hour. This is Tom Hartman with you, broadcasting live from the People's Republic of Vermont, coast to coast around the United States. 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to be on the program today. Chris in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Oh, thank you, Tom. The Richard Clark interview, kaboom.
Yeah.
I watched the interview, and then immediately I went to talk radio because I wanted to see how the Republicans were going to...
Stories of courage need to be shared. That's why we want to tell you about Senators Bob Graham and Bill Nelson. They have stood strong to protect our coastlines from exploration and drilling by powerful oil and gas companies. But the fight's not over. Congress is now pushing an energy bill that still threatens our coastlines with oil and gas activities, hands billions of dollars in tax breaks over to the oil, gas, coal, and nuclear companies, and could exempt polluters from clean air and safe drinking water laws. What's more, this so-called energy bill doesn't cut our dangerous dependence on foreign oil, fix what's wrong with our aging energy grid, adequately promote renewable wind and solar power, protect consumers, or increase the efficiency or security of our energy system. There is a better way. Call Senators Graham and Nelson at 202-225-3121. Thank them for their courage and ask them to reject this dangerous energy bill. Paid for by the Florida CFPB.
The best of the rest of the news. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Holders on the one-way
Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
In less than a year. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes past the hour. It's the bad news is coming in all directions here for this administration. It turns out that you apparently can't lie to the American people and get away with it. Newsweek. Everybody's talking about Richard Clark, and of course we'll get to that in a little more detail here in a moment. But Newsweek has this story out now. It's going to be in the next issue, apparently, of Newsweek. It just hit the newswire. Newsweek has learned that in the months before 9/11, the U.S. Justice Department curtailed a highly classified program called Catcher's Mitt to monitor al-Qaeda suspects in the United States. During the Bush administration's first few months in office, Attorney General John Ashcroft downgraded terrorism as a priority, choosing to put more emphasis on drug trafficking. Yeah, we need to go after Cheech and Chong. That was John Ashcroft's concern. How much damage have Bush's lies about Iraq done to the war on terror? Yeah, we are reconnected, Rama. Thank you. How much damage, how much, what is this? We've seen now Spain turn their back on us. The president of Italy is talking like this. Mikhail Gorbachev yesterday, the former head of the Soviet Union, Nobel Peace Prize winner. I've kind of mixed feelings about the guy, but anyhow, he came out and he said, this was a terrible thing. He said, "This is a war based on lies. What? Where is it all going to go? How? What are we going to do about this?" 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to be on our program today, Dave in Eureka, California, is on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
And to you, Tom, excellent program as always. There's so much deception coming down from this administration. One aspect of it that I am prepared to speak to firsthand and directly is that we do have one federal agency that is comprised largely of high-tech and low-charactered hacker goons. These are folks that have the ability to invade your internet and to obstruct whistleblowers and such, but their primary purpose is going to be to rig the next election, and that as more and more we move in the direction of
I know, Dave, there's a lot of people concerned about that, but in the about a half a minute or so left we've got here, you said you have specific evidence.
I am one of those folks that blew the whistle on a massive government fraud and has been saddled with these goons for now quite a long period of time. Yes, and they're very blatant, they're quite clear in their threats.
Interesting. What, for example?
Oh, they tell me whatever they want. They make no pretense of hiding the fact that they're there. Some of them do, but most of them don't. Most of them are very blatant.
Yeah.
You have to go to a. It's something I think we're going to need a paper record of whatever votes are cast.
Yeah,
or
I think
they will just simply change our votes to whatever they want.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, so whether or not you're the victim of a conspiracy, Dave, which I can't speak to and you're not being, real specific about, I agree with you that we do have a real concern in the United States about the integrity of our vote with these voting machines that don't show a paper ballot. And good point. Well made. Thanks, Dave, for the call. 1-866-889-8894. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A recent report prepared by the Democratic staff of the U.S. House Education and Workforce Committee hangs the most solid number yet on the hidden costs of shopping at Walmart. The committee figures each Walmart store with a staff of 200 or more puts a $420,750 burden on local federal taxpayers for social services costs. These would include housing, education, energy, and tax benefits awarded to workers like those at Walmart who are not paid a living wage and for the most part do not have health insurance.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell signed an executive order last week at the AFL-CIO's 36th Constitutional Convention prohibiting state contracts from going to sweatshop apparel or laundry companies. Any industry signing a contract with the state must prove they pay their employees an hourly rate at least equivalent to the poverty threshold and provide working conditions meeting or exceeding the International Labor Organization's convention's rules, governing wage and hour laws, forced labor, child labor, occupational health and safety, and non-discrimination. However, the order doesn't ban the state from contracting with firms that use prison labor.
Former President Ronald Reagan's busting of the National Air Traffic Controllers Union during the early 1980s is coming back to haunt the Federal Aviation Administration. The FAA projects more than 7,000 of the nation's 15,000 air traffic controllers will become eligible to retire over the next decade, and it has no substantive plan to replace them. Many of those set to retire are the replacements of those union controllers fired en masse by Reagan in 1982.
George W. Bush's 2004 re-election campaign broke the president's own sanctions against one of the world's most repressive regimes recently, when it sold garments produced in the military dictatorship of Burma. A fleece pullover bearing the logo Bush Cheney 04 retailed for $49.95 on the website of the campaign to re-elect the president. According to the National Labor Committee, Burmese textile workers would have to work 713 hours in order to afford a Bush-Cheney pullover.
For the last several months, the British government's been mulling over an overhaul of the civil service workforce. Key to the plan was the moving of 20,000 London-area government jobs to regional offices. The proposal would save the government money by not having to pay for the higher cost of living in London. But the scope of the plan has now been dramatically expanded. As many as 20,000 jobs will still move from London, while another 65,000 now are targeted for dismissal, all within the next 4 years. British public sector unions call the move irresponsible, not only because of the radically reduced services that will result, but also because of the expected collapse in morale among the government workforce.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to Solutions for Progress Incorporated, American workers are 81% more productive today than they were in 1968, and corporate profits are 39% higher when adjusted for inflation. But minimum wage workers earn nearly 40% less than their counterparts did a generation ago. The lowest paid workers received $1.65 an hour in 1968, the equivalent of $8.45 in 2003. You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing you uncommon sense, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The horror of September the 11th. We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people.
As said during a speech about Iraq,
our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon.
And welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you. George Bush.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Oh, no, says Rumsfeld. We never said there was an imminent threat. But increasingly it's looking like this thing, you know, that maybe it had something to do with George wanting to finish his father's business. Maybe it had something to do with Karl Rove thinking, you know, if we have a successful war, we'll get a heck of a bounce out of that in the polls and we'll win the election. You know, if George Bush Sr. had simply not finished his war in 100 hours, but let it run for like 3 weeks, he probably would have won the election. He got such a bounce out of that thing, and then it faded. If he had just, 3 months, let's say, if he had just let it run a little longer. So it might have been, you know, Karl Rove saying, hey, you know, war is a good thing to get you reelected. It worked for Franklin Roosevelt, worked for Lyndon Johnson, worked for Richard Nixon. Could be. But increasingly the evidence coming not from left-wing kooks, but, well, from right-wing kooks, I suppose you could say, from Judicial Watch, from, you know, the organization that sued Bill Clinton over Jennifer Flowers that led to Monica Lewinsky. The evidence, and, well, really not from them. I mean, the evidence came from Dick Cheney's own energy policy meetings that 3 months after Cheney and Bush took power, Cheney met in secret with the senior executives and major lobbyists from the world's largest oil companies and laid out a plan to carve up the oil fields of Iraq, much to the profit of Halliburton, which was in all probability represented in that meeting. We don't know, because Dick Cheney is going to go to the Supreme Court to keep us from knowing what he was doing while he was on our payroll. And that it might be that this whole thing was just about oil. Just about oil. Could it be? I mean, people have been saying no war for oil. What a cynical thing. Glenn from Florida disagrees. Hey, Glenn, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. Thanks for calling 1-866-889-8894.
Joe from Brookings, Oregon.
Oh, that's Joe. I'm sorry. I got my lines backwards. Hey, Joe, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
They're talking about this is supposed to be some political reason why Richard Clark is coming out with this new book and all that, and his criticisms of the Bush administration. If I remember right, when I first heard about this book coming out a couple days ago, Richard Clark wasn't necessarily all that complimentary towards the Clinton administration either. When it comes to failures and combating terrorism.
Well, it's mixed. It's a mixed bag, because he points out that when Clinton in 99 got alerts that al-Qaeda was intending to attack the United States, he ordered his cabinet to meet every day about it, so that the cabinet officials, the head of the FBI, the head of the CIA, every day had to go back to their offices and say, what do you guys know? And they were pulling in stuff from, you know, they were digging down deep and pulling in stuff, and that allowed them to stop the guy in who tried to cross the Canadian border with a carload full of explosives, where he was going to go to LAX airport and blow it up, which would have been, you know, a spectacular, in the terrible sense of the word, a spectacular attack against the United States to take out an airport. Because think of all those jets, you know, with all that jet fuel and stuff. I mean, you blow up LAX and 30, 40 jets go up, and it would have been thousands of people dying. And it would have been, you know, as horrific as the World Trade Center attack. And Clinton successfully stopped that by taking Richard Clark's advice and demanding this information. And now, as Clark pointed out last night, the FBI was and the CIA both knew about these al-Qaeda guys that were in the United States, but the people at the top, the George Tenet and who had been there during the Clinton administration, which baffles me, and Ashcroft were not, and particularly the FBI was the one who had it. What was that woman in Wisconsin's name who blew the whistle on it, or Minnesota? Anyway.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about. And Ashcroft was not going out and saying, what do you know? What do you know? Dig a little deeper. Dig a little deeper. There's a problem here. Something's going to happen. And of course, something happened. So Clark, in a way, compliments Clinton. He said, you know, he did something about it. And he also, Clinton had these plans at the after the USS Cole was bombed in October of 2000. By November and December, Clinton had put together a plan to attack Afghanistan, take out the training camps, and kill bin Laden, and kill or capture bin Laden. And he decided not to execute that in late November, early December of 2000, because Al Gore had just lost the election, or, you know, based on the Supreme Court. We don't need to go there, but you know the point.
Yeah.
And George Bush was going to be the president, and Bill Clinton thought that it wouldn't be fair to do what Richard Nixon did to Jack Kennedy, you know, handing him off the Bay of Pigs operation and saying, hey, surprise, I've been planning a war, and here you go. So this got handed off from Sandy Berger to Condi Rice, who is refusing to testify before the 9/11 Commission next week.
Yes,
and so.
Well, the point being that this guy ain't exactly a cheerleader for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, no, he's clearly not. I mean, he started out with working for Reagan.
Yeah, of course, and so I believe the guy to be completely credible, and going on from that to this September 11th commission, this whole deal with the failure to combat terrorism, you know, if it all turns out with this September 11th commission to be a bipartisan screw up, I hope we don't wind up seeing a bipartisan cover up. Like we saw with Iran-Contra, and the reason I mention that is who's the Democratic head of the committee? Lee Hamilton. Lee Hamilton helped cover up Iran-Contra back in the 80s, and he did the same thing with the October surprise theory, which is what we found out the truth about that.
Well, and here's the other thing that's got a lot of people scratching their heads. This from the New York Times, an article by Philip Shannon, Clinton aides plan to tell panel of warning Bush team on Al-Qaeda. This is in today's New York Times. Actually, it's 2 days ago, New York Times. And let me just quote two lines. They don't run together in the article, but they said the warnings were delivered in urgent post-election intelligence briefings in December 2000 and January 2001 for Condoleezza Rice, who became Mr. Bush's national security advisor, Stephen Hadley, now Ms. Rice's deputy, he was the one who was defending her on 60 Minutes last night, and Philip D. Zelikow, a member of the Bush transition team, among others. Now, get that. Philip D. Zelikow was one of the guys who was getting the briefings from Sandy Berger and the rest of the and Dick Clark and the rest of the guys in the Clinton team saying, look out, Al-Qaeda is coming. We've got a plan to get them. Now, five, six paragraphs down in the article, it goes on to say, the testimony could also prove uncomfortable for the commission since Mr. Zelikow is now the executive director of that bipartisan panel.
Yeah, well, that figures. As far as I'm concerned, Condoleezza Rice ought to be testifying behind prison bars. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot, Joe. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8895. This is senior Clinton administration officials called to testify next week before the independent commission investigating the 9/11 attacks say they are prepared to detail how, this is from the New York Times, this article by Philip Shannon, to detail how they repeatedly warned their Bush administration counterparts in late 2000 that Al-Qaeda posed the worst security threat facing the nation and how the new administration was slow to act. And we're going to have sworn testimony, that's under oath, this week, and scheduled for tomorrow and the day after, from former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, former Defense Secretary William Cohen, and former National Security Advisor Samuel R. Berger, Sandy Berger. And will Condoleezza Rice testify? No. She says the American people have no right to know what she was up to. Those are not literally her words, but certainly the point of it. So then we get to Richard Clark. And what he said last night on 60 Minutes. This was really quite extraordinary. Just a few quotes here. He says, frankly, I find it outrageous that the president is running for re-election on the grounds that he's done such great things about terrorism. He ignored it. He ignored terrorism for months when maybe we could have done something to stop 9/11. Now, this is the guy who was George W. Bush's anti-terrorism czar. He was the number one anti-terrorism official in the Bush White House for the first 2.5 years of this administration. He said, he goes on to say, I think he's done, he's speaking of George Bush, a terrible job on the war against terrorism. He goes on to say that right after 9/11, they pulled together this meeting after Bush gets back to the White House. And he says, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was pushing for retaliatory strikes on Al-Qaeda, on Iraq, even though Al-Qaeda was based in Afghanistan. And Clark says, the idea of, as I recall, he said it was sort of like saying, if Japan attacked us at Pearl Harbor in retaliation, we invade Mexico. He basically said to Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld said, we've been attacked. Let's attack Iraq. And he said, there's no Al-Qaeda in Iraq. There are no terrorists in Iraq. There's, a tin pot dictator there who's terrorizing his own people, as are, 50 others around the world. But there's no terrorists there. But Rumsfeld says, no, we've got to do this. And he says, why? And he says, Rumsfeld says, there's no good targets to bomb in Afghanistan. There are good targets in Iraq. What? This is what he said to Leslie Stahl last night. Rumsfeld was saying that we needed to bomb Iraq. And he said, no. And we said, no. Al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan. We need to bomb Afghanistan. And Rumsfeld said there weren't any good targets in Afghanistan. And there are lots of good targets in Iraq. And I said, there's lots of good targets in lots of places, but Iraq had nothing to do with it. Initially, I thought when he said there aren't enough targets in Afghanistan, I thought he was joking. These are quotes from Richard Clark, the terrorism czar under George W. Bush. He said the CIA was sitting there, the FBI was sitting there, I was sitting there saying we've looked at this issue for years. For years we've looked, and there's just no connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. I mean, George Bush himself said that. Do you remember? I mean, it was pretty unambiguous.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. No evidence. In his own words. 1-866-889-8894. Dean in Santa Fe, New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Dean, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you very much, Tom. I guess in an ideal world, what I would like to see is the 9/11 Commission on TV, all the members present, and one by one, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Mueller, Tenet, the generals that canceled their planes on September 10th, the FEMA head who said that his people were in place September 10th, Condoleezza Rice, who Willie Brown in San Francisco said her office warned him not to get on a plane on September 10th. Shouldn't we have this on every, at least one designated network, the whole complete hearings of any of these people, and then repeated for those people that can't watch?
Well, you know what would happen. I mean, what you're describing is exactly what Sam Ervin did with the Watergate hearings. I mean, the Watergate hearings were held in open, and what it led to was Nixon resigning. I mean, there's right now a bill before Congress that is probably not going to get out of committee because the Republicans control it, to censure Bush, which is, slap his hand. And MoveOn.org is promoting that, as well as other groups.
Well, not every person that lost loved ones in 9/11 has taken the money and shut up. I mean, you have that woman from Pennsylvania, that Italian lady, who has a suit in federal court.
Right, a RICO lawsuit.
Exactly. What I'd like to see.
Yeah. Okay. Well said. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call there, Dean. And well said. It would be nice to have some accountability. This administration has been very, very good at burying the facts, obfuscation. It's going to be really interesting to see. I mean, if it really is true that Dick Cheney was the driving force behind this, that he was the guy who back before 9/11 had come up with the plan to attack Iraq to get its oil and enrich Halliburton and his other oil buddies, it's going to be really interesting to hear what he has to say, because no doubt he will be the one that they will trot out to defend this administration's policies. Natalie in Ohio is on the line. Hey, Natalie, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. My concern, I guess, is that I'm not seeing John Kerry take these issues and fully use them the way I feel like he should be in this situation.
Don't you think, though, that he would then be attacked, that then it would all become political, and Kerry's really trying to say, hey, this is a real national security issue. We really need to know the truth, rather than turning it into a campaign thing.
The way that the Republicans have done, though, they've taken this stuff and repeated it over and over and over again like it's the truth, and we need to be doing the same thing.
Yeah. Well, good point, Natalie. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Tom Hartman, 10 minutes before the hour. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly. And they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America, Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com. Or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. Have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
I will, thanks.
If you own a piece of land, you might not own what's beneath it. That's a growing issue for people in western states. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Many western ranchers have no control over mining or drilling on their property. They don't own the minerals beneath their feet because of what's called a split estate. The government often owns the mineral rights and leases them to developers. Jill Morrison is with the Powder River Basin Resource Council, a group representing landowners in northeastern Wyoming.
So a lot of people in the West live on land
where the government owns the minerals beneath them. And in a lot of the way the law is written at federal and state levels, the mineral development takes precedent over someone's surface land rights.
Morrison says that fact has become painfully real for Wyoming ranchers whose land lies over deep deposits of natural gas. The gas industry is rapidly developing wells in the Powder River Basin to tap into this methane, which is trapped in coal beds.
And so people have drillers coming to their homes saying, you know, we have leased the rights under your land. We're going to come on a drill. We're going to drill 120 wells on your ranch. Here's our plan and sign here. Basically, you have no or very little negotiating authority about how it's going to take place on your land.
Morrison, whose family has ranched in the area for generations, says a landowner can spend thousands of dollars in legal fees trying to negotiate with the gas drillers. She says most companies offer some compensation, but it's not enough to cover the drillers' use of the land or the mess they leave behind. Morrison's group is advocating changes in state and federal laws to address the issue of split estates. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
The best of the rest of the news, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Intelligence gathered by this and other governments leaves no doubt that the Iraqi regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised.
And welcome back. 4 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And we have Sarah in Santa Fe on the line. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. I haven't been able to listen to all of it, so maybe somebody brought this up, but real quick, I have noticed, as I'm sure many of your listeners have noticed, a correlation between a revelation such as Clark's and a world event that steals the headlines. We have the killing of the Hamas leader. And if that hadn't happened when it did, the Clark news would be all over the front pages everywhere. But yeah. Now you have about 2 or 3 minutes of Clark, and then they say, well, we'll get back to this, but we want to report on the assassination of the Hamas leader. This happened, yeah. I believe, during the Paul Wellstone plane crash. It happened when Valerie Plame's husband, Joseph, what's his name?
Wilson.
Yes. There was one day that was particularly big for the expose that he was presenting, and I cannot remember what it was, but there was something in the international
news. Well, there's a well-documented, Sarah, well-documented train of events where the administration has, for example, had terrorists that they've held for weeks or, in one case, over a month, and then dropped them into the media on a particularly bad media day. And there certainly has been, you know, there's clear evidence that the press has been manipulated by Rove and the White House in the past. Whether the, you know, Israel's going to line up with us on this and whether, you know, frankly, I doubt it. I think that
I personally don't think Israel makes a move without consulting the United States on major.
Yeah,
that
could,
is on major issues.
On major issues, yeah. But you know, taking out the
Hamas leader is a major issue.
It is, but it also requires opportunity. It's not something that you can just do at a particular time.
Well,
so,
that's true.
You know,
I'm not skeptical. Saying that anything's, you know.
Yeah, it's a shame that we're thinking like this. I mean, that's the real problem.
You have to think like this because once you start thinking like this, then of course, people can say, well, you create your own reality.
There you go. Sarah, I got
to
go.
Coincidences we have to observe before we start smelling something fishy. But anyway, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Tom Hartman here with you. Helping you win the water cooler war. Democracy is coming to the U.S.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Walmart doesn't just dominate the discount retail and grocery industries. It's muscling in on a much more lucrative market, campaign contributions. Walmart is currently the second largest overall donor in the 2004 election cycle, according to an analysis by the Center for Responsive Politics, giving 85% of its donations to Republicans and 15% to Democrats. In the 2002 federal election cycle, Walmart came in 71st among the top 100 donors. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. If British researchers in continuing education did their math correctly, those who enter the workforce 20 years from now can expect to work in 19 different jobs over their lifetime. Not only that, the number of people working two or more jobs is expected to double by 2025. Those projections are heavily influenced by two factors: a rising life expectancy coupled with underfunded pensions and individual retirement savings.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Don Waller in New York. George W. Bush ignored the threat of Al-Qaeda for months and did too little to stop the September 11th attacks on the United States, a former administration counterterrorism official said Sunday. Richard Clark's accusations, aired in a CBS 60 Minutes interview, drew a detailed point-by-point rebuttal from the White House as it attempted to defend Bush's standing as a presidential candidate who is tough on terrorism. In the program on his book to be launched Monday, Clark charged that Bush had done a terrible job in addressing the threat from terrorism. Former President Jimmy Carter has strongly criticized George Bush and Tony Blair for waging an unnecessary war to oust Saddam Hussein based on lies or misinterpretations. The 2002 Nobel Peace Prize winner said Mr. Blair had allowed his better judgment to be swayed by Mr. Bush's desire to finish a war that his father had started. In an interview with the British newspaper The Independent on the first anniversary of the American and British invasion of Iraq, Carter said the Iraq war was based on lies and misinterpretations from London and from Washington, claiming falsely that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the 9/11 attacks and claiming falsely that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Reports that led to charges against six U.S. soldiers accused of abusing detainees at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison came from within the military, not from prisoner complaints, a senior U.S. military official said Sunday. The soldiers, members of a military police unit, were charged Saturday with a range of crimes including conspiracy, dereliction of duty, cruelty and maltreatment, assault, and indecent acts with another person. The military said about 20 detainees at the prison on the western outskirts of Baghdad were involved. Israel killed Hamas founder Ahmed Yassin in a helicopter missile strike outside a Gaza City mosque Monday, prompting threats of unprecedented revenge by Palestinian militants against Israel and the United States. Yassin was the most prominent Palestinian leader killed by Israel in more than 3 years of fighting, and his assassination was seen as a major escalation. More Minuteman News after this.
I'm Oscar Davis. You may have a serious eye condition and not even know it. Vision loss is not a normal part of aging. Some vision changes are normal, some are due to eye disease. Do you know the difference? Open your eyes to the facts. To get more information about vision and aging, or find out about what help is available if you're having vision problems, call Lighthouse International at 1-800-829-0500 or visit www.lighthouse.org.
A West Virginia man accused of robbing a convenience store left a big clue behind for investigators: his wallet. Terry Lee Romine of Hansford was charged with robbing the V-Mart in Comfort, West Virginia, Friday morning. He allegedly ordered a slice of pizza and then demanded cash from the clerk, saying he had a gun. As he fled, the clerk looked down and saw the man's wallet on the counter. For the Minuteman News Service, this is Don Waller in New York.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
Pop. Pundits and other political cynics scoff at citizens' efforts to reform America's money-corrupted political process, saying it's as futile as trying to teach table manners to a hog. The effort wears you out, and it only annoys the hog. That's cute, but if the cynics would only lift their eyes from their myopic focus on Washington, they would see something big taking place in such diverse states as Maine and Arizona. Citizens in both places have already passed grassroots initiatives providing for dramatic reform, public financing of elections. These clean election initiatives give candidates of any party the chance to finance both their primary and general election campaigns with public funds, provided they forego taking special interest money. Not only does this help get corrupt money out of the process, but it also means a regular person can run for office again, since a school teacher, taxi driver, farmer, shopkeeper, steelworker, or anyone else has access to a pool of money to make them financially competitive with the incumbents. Maine and Arizona have run two election cycles under clean money laws, and the results would warm the cockles of the coldest cynic's heart. There have been more challengers to incumbents than before, with more women, Latinos, and Native Americans running and winning. Half of the challengers using the clean money option say they would not have run without it. Because this system creates more choices, offering fresh faces and new ideas, voter turnout is ratcheting upward. And here's the big one. Public financing is working. 59% of Maine's legislators and 36% of those in Arizona have now been elected without taking any tainted money. And publicly funded candidates in Arizona last year won 7 of 9 statewide offices, including the governor and attorney general. This is Jim Hightower saying, if you want clean elections, call Public Campaign, 202-293-0222.
I'll just see who that is then.
Oh no! South American killer bees! They're going for my eye!
A swarm of killer bees. That's one thing you don't want in your house. One thing you do want in your house is a better looking roof with Plitanium plywood from Georgia Pacific. Other roof sheathing materials can swell at the edges, creating an unsightly checkerboard pattern under your shingles. Plitanium roofs provide a more uniform surface. Plitanium plywood. Build it better.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, friends. 7 minutes past the hour. Yeah, this is just absolutely remarkable. This testimony, the commentary. I haven't seen the book, Richard Clark's book, but just, you know, what he said on 60 Minutes last night. Absolutely startling. One of the things that concerned me the most was he told Leslie Stahl of being pressured by George Bush to tell Americans, or to tell Bush rather, to tell the government that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. Here's what he said to Leslie Stahl. He says, "The president dragged me into a room with a couple of other people, shut the door, and said, quote, 'I want you to find out whether Iraq did this,' end quote." Now, you know, he acknowledges the president didn't say, "I want you to make up a lie that Iraq did this." He said, "I want you to find out." He says, "But the entire conversation left me in absolutely no doubt that George Bush wanted me to come back with a report that said Iraq did this. I said, 'Mr. President, we've done this before. We've been looking at this. We looked at it with an open mind. There's no connection.' He came back at me and said, 'Iraq, Saddam, find out if there's a connection.' And in a very intimidating way." So Clark went back and looked again. Went through all the intelligence. I mean, the guy was the counterterrorism czar. He was the head terrorism expert in the executive branch of government. He put together this thing, and he goes and he sends it back. He says it was a serious look. This quoting again from Clark speaking to Leslie Stahl last night on CBS. It was a serious look. We got together all the FBI experts, all the CIA experts. We wrote the report. We sent the report out to CIA and found FBI and said, will you sign this report? They all cleared the report. And we sent it up to the president, and it got bounced back by the National Security Advisor or deputy. It got, that would be Condoleezza Rice or Hadley, her number two guy. It got bounced and sent back saying, wrong answer, do it again. He says, we did it again. It came to the same conclusion. Finally, he goes on to say that he thinks even he deserves some blame. He says, on January 24th, 2001, I wrote a memo to Condoleezza Rice asking for urgently, underlined urgently, a cabinet-level meeting. Now, this was just weeks after the administration came into power. 9 months before 9/11. A cabinet-level meeting to deal with the impending Al-Qaeda attack, and that urgent memo wasn't acted on. And this guy, you know, he says he's still feeling guilty about this. He talks about Paul Wolfowitz. We'll continue with this. Mike in Florida is on the line. 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to be on the program today. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. Before I get into this real quick, have you ever noticed it seems like Condoleezza Rice's voice tends to crack quite a bit when her story's going awry?
Yeah, I've noticed. I noticed that, and I noticed that also with Colin Powell, that when he is clearly lying, if you go back and you look at some of the things that he said before the United Nations, and there were obviously some of them that he actually believed, and some of them that he either knew to be lies or that he had very serious doubts about, because his voice would crack also, and had a funny up inflection in it. I have noticed that.
What amazes me about this whole thing is the irresponsibility of the media. I was watching it last night. My jaw dropped, not just because what he was saying, because we've heard it before. And it's the way the media is not asking the right questions and doing anything about it. If they were aggressive on it, we'd be way past this point right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you've read Paul O'Neill's book yet. It's very consistent with the way things were held then.
Yeah, Paul O'Neill was saying essentially the same thing.
And, yeah, and 10 days in, he said, meeting adjourned. It was about Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, Wesley Clark, on the day of 9/11, they were trying to make a connection. Joseph Wilson, we know about. Ray McGovern, Greg Thielman, the other threat analyst. And, the ones that resigned, the diplomats, Kiesling, Brown, Mary Wright, Rand Beers, the counterterrorism expert, they're all saying the same thing. Yet when somebody comes out, the response is always, they're disgruntled, they're either trying to sell a book, or the timing is suspect, that they never say anything about the actual content of what they're saying.
Yeah, I mean, people have been saying this about this administration essentially since 9/11, that you know, there's a hidden agenda here. We don't know what it is or why it is. And now increasingly it's looking like it might have to do with Dick Cheney's energy meetings, which would be so tragic in my mind. I mean, it's so sad to think that nearly 600 of our young men and women would die, and that thousands. I mean, we've had to medically evacuate 12,000 people now from Iraq, 3,000 that we know have serious injuries. The Pentagon has admitted to, or the Department of Defense rather. Pentagon says it's 12,000.
But it's so obvious. I mean, they talk about our interest in the Middle East, and it's not sand.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's
how the people let it go on, I don't know.
Yeah,
I went down to Orlando to welcome George down here to kick off his campaign. There were a few hundred of us out there with signs, and we were getting a lot of positive feedback from the traffic going by for the most part.
Did you get herded into a free speech zone, Mike?
No, we were up the street quite a bit to where the entrance was, where he was going to come back into the convention center.
Did they have a free speech zone organized for that one?
Pardon?
Did they have a free speech? I was wondering if he was going to stop doing the free speech zone.
No, I didn't see anything like that, and the crowd wasn't rowdy at all as far as that's concerned. It was pretty well organized. And
yeah, interesting. I'm figuring that they've backed off on that a little bit. Mike, thanks for the call.
All right, you take care.
Good points made. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, 8 minutes past the hour. Kodak in Greensboro, North Carolina, driving a truck through there, right?
Hello.
Hey, Kodak, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Tom. One thing that I've noticed in today's news, also, I listened to a program on C-SPAN today regarding the press coverage of the war, the information leading up to the war, and how they gave themselves a pass on that since the American people weren't behind anyone investigating these matters. And the thing that I noticed when they were debating the Paul this story here about Richard Clark's book, no one has brought up the fact that the administration is so free of guilt. Why hasn't the administration stepped up to the plate and willing to testify in front of the commission?
Well, not just that, Kodak. Why didn't they? I mean, you know, when Pearl Harbor happened, the first thing Franklin Roosevelt did was say, I want to know what happened. I want a commission. I want an investigation into this, and I want it out in the open. And, you know, there's still questions to this day about it. A lot of people aren't satisfied. But nonetheless, I mean, that was the investigation. And you know, why, if this administration has nothing to hide, Why were they so reluctant to have a 9/11 commission in the first place?
In the first place, right.
Why did they refuse to testify? Why are they refusing to testify before it? Why did George Bush try and shut it off as of last week? It was supposed to, you know, expire last week, and it was only the outcry of legislators that continued it. As a consequence, in large part, I'd say, of the MoveOn.org email campaign.
Right.
You know, why are they trying to bury this stuff?
Right, and why limit it to only a specific amount of time? Why limit it to just the two top Republicans that are on the committee? I listen to C-SPAN a lot. Well, not a lot. I really try to cut back my intake of the horrors going on in the world just to keep my sanity. But I listen to a lot of people that call in, and they just have their so ingrained in their own opinion about what they have heard. They don't really care about the facts, or they're zealous about the dogma that they want to believe. And I've had this discussion with many people. You know, if you can't see the corruption in this administration, you don't want to see it. And, you know, when I've been asked, you know, where do I get the information, I say, once again, if you don't want to get information, if you can't get the information yourself, you know, you don't really want it because
it's out there. It's in the news all the time. It's a funny dichotomy, because on the one hand we're saying, oh, the news isn't doing, you know, the media isn't doing a good job reporting this stuff, and on the other hand, all the stuff that you and I have, and all of our callers have been talking about the last hour and 10 minutes here, has been in the media.
Yeah, that's the point I wanted to call in this morning to C-SPAN, when they was talking about someone has written a book revering the media's handling of this entire episode.
Yeah,
and I wanted to call. And they were saying, well, we really couldn't get at the facts. We really couldn't prove that these things were not true. And I wanted to call in, wait a minute, that is absurd, because, you know, a lot of people knew that these things were not qualifiable.
Yeah.
Just the science of how long the shelf life of the supposed biochemical hazards that they supposedly possess, the link between the graves, all of those things, the link between the mass graves, as they're called, we know that these graves are attributed to our involvement. And the press, you know, they wanted to give themselves a pass, like, oh, yes, looking up back in hindsight, yes, we could have did better.
Yeah.
No, they dropped the ball.
Yeah.
Great show, as usual.
Thanks, Kodak. Great to hear from you. Keep driving safely there.
Oh, I'll pull over when I stop to talk, trust me.
Okay, good. All righty. Talk to you later. Thanks for the call. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Armin in Florida is on the line. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, I got an idea for the Democrats if they're serious about overtaking the White House.
Okay. Hey, before you do that, something one of the folks in the chat room mentioned, and you just reminded me of it. You know, an earlier caller had said, why isn't Kerry taking this thing and beating George Bush up with it? And you know, the president has to look presidential. It's why George Bush doesn't beat up John Kerry. Instead, he has Dick Cheney do it for him. And of course, Kerry doesn't have a vice presidential candidate right now, so he's got Ted Kennedy out there beating people up for him. So really, that's I think it's spinning along. So anyhow, your suggestion.
I think that they ought to run ads and say another Bush administration access ACCESSS of evil moment. And then they can, right, they can show different times and, you know, who this crime family surrounds herself with and who takes money, like the Rumsfeld handshake with Saddam.
Yeah.
And then the big insurance companies giving campaign contributions to CEOs, pictures of them, you know, Kenny Boy, you know, Mr. Enron.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know Kenny Boy. And then, you know, put the ad up there and show all the connections with him and where is he now, which one of his mansions.
Yeah.
You know, and just call it another Bush administration access of evil moment.
Yeah.
And then make a short one. What do you think of that?
I think that's an interesting idea, Armin. I, you know, I think that one of the things that the Democrats haven't done a good job of, and I'll be very disappointed if they don't by the time this campaign is out, is tying, you know, connecting the dots, as it were, between Bush and the institutions to whom he is beholden. I think you raise a good one. Armin, thanks for the call. Always good to hear from you. 20 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do they know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
You.
What?
Who was Rudolf Nureyev?
Wasn't he a defenseman for the Maple Leafs?
Yeah, okay. Can you tell me who Louis Armstrong was?
He was the first guy on the moon.
Mm.
You know, one small step for man.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org, because all kids should get to appreciate Nureyev's dance and Armstrong's horn. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and...
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to Solutions for Progress Incorporated, American workers are 81% more productive today than they were in 1968, and corporate profits are 39% higher when adjusted for inflation. But minimum wage workers earn nearly 40% less than their counterparts did a generation ago. The lowest paid workers received $1.65 an hour in 1968, the equivalent of $8.45 in 2003.
Hi, this is Emily Richards for RAD, recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. One person's negligence shattered my life in a single instant. You see, my little sister Annie was killed by a drunk driver. Please remember those you love. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters.
bringing you uncommon sense. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman with you, discussing solutions and not false promises. Here, Richard Clark, last night on 60 Minutes, he was talking about Paul Wolfowitz. Wasn't Wolfowitz who had said to Vanity Fair, well, we used weapons of mass destruction because it was essentially an acceptable rationalization for the war? Anyhow, Clark says, I began saying we have to deal with bin Laden. We have to deal with Al-Qaeda. And Paul Wolfowitz, as Deputy Secretary of Defense, said, no, we don't have to deal with Al-Qaeda. Why are we talking about that little guy? We have to talk about Iraqi terrorism against the United States. And I said, this being Richard Clark speaking, Paul, there hasn't been any Iraqi terrorism against the United States in 8 years. And I turned to the deputy, and that was when Saddam hired a hitman to go after George Bush Sr. And he says, and I turned to the deputy director of the CIA, and I said, isn't that right? And he said, yeah, that's right. There's no Iraqi terrorism against the United States. Clark went on to add, there's absolutely no evidence that Iraq was supporting Al-Qaeda ever. Ever. And then he goes on to say that George Tenet was saying to the White House, saying to the president, because he briefed him every morning, a major Al-Qaeda attack is going to happen against the United States somewhere in the world in the weeks and months ahead. He said that in June. He said that in July. He said that in August. And it happened in September. This is just absolutely remarkable. And what's it leading to here now? Did you see the story? The U.S. House of Representatives and Senate have introduced new legislation to bring back the military draft. Not only bring back the draft, but for the first time to include women in it. Interesting. We'll see what comes of that. What are your thoughts on that? 26 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Program here, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to be on the air. Kip in Eureka, California is on the line. Hey, Kip, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going, Tom? Listen to you all the time.
Great.
I got a really good book your listeners might want to check out at their bookstore. It's called Why America Slept by Gerald Posner. And I read the review in Time Magazine. Excellent review about 9/11. It'll give you everything.
Have you actually read the book? Because Gerald Posner is the guy who wrote the book about the Kennedy assassination, in which he said, oh, no, there was no conspiracy. It was just Oswald, you know, nothing to worry about. Posner's credibility with me is very low, frankly.
Oh, yeah.
So I haven't read his book. I haven't read this book, though. Have you?
But Ed, to give you a little bit of the insight on what it was, it turns out it was the Saudi oil kings, King of Fahd's son and stuff like that.
That did what?
That set up 9/11, and they also funded 9/11 and stuff like that, and the terrorists and all that.
You mean intentionally? We know that Osama bin Laden got money. His family, his father was George Bush's business partner, the bin Laden construction company. A huge family and well-connected into the royal family in Saudi Arabia. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the Saudi family had anything to do with it.
Well, if you watched on the church service about a week after 9/11, if you watched... Colin Powell and Jimmy Carter were sitting there talking, and I just happened to read Carter's lips, and Carter said it was all a big setup.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, if you can really read lips, Kip.
Well, I can.
Yeah, okay. All righty. Well,
all right, talk to you later.
Okay, thanks a lot. 1-866-889-8894. 27 minutes past the hour. Ron in Miami, Florida is on the line. Hey, Ron, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Great. We've got about 30 seconds here.
Considering that we have a short attention span in this country, especially because of the MTV generation, couldn't somebody take a visual flowchart, so to say, of Rumsfeld's connections and his consulting business and how that ties in with Hal Bertrand and George Bush's dad, bin Laden's, the Saudis, and just do it in a way where it could be easily visual.
Yeah, it needs to be.
Within a minute or two, have that emailed out everywhere, like George Bush's resume, and that's affecting a lot of people.
Yeah, it needs to be done as a comic book. I mean, I have an illustrated book actually coming out this week about these many of these issues, and I think you make a good point. We've got an ADD society here now, increasingly. Good point, Ron. Thanks for the call. 1-866-889-8894. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the Republican National Committee. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
When Bush got into the driver's seat, he took over the largest surplus in American history and turned that surplus into the largest deficit in history. The U.S. economy has lost 3.3 million jobs, the most since the Great Depression. Then Bush drove us into war with Iraq. We're losing lives. We're hemorrhaging money. And these costs are driving our country closer to bankruptcy. Just where does George Bush think he's taking?
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell signed an executive order last week at the AFL-CIO's 36th Constitutional Convention prohibiting state contracts from going to sweatshop apparel or laundry companies. Any industry signing a contract with the state must prove they pay their employees an hourly rate at least equivalent to the poverty threshold and provide working conditions meeting or exceeding the International Labor Organization's convention's rules governing wage and hour laws, forced labor, child labor, occupational health and safety, and non-discrimination. However, the order doesn't ban the state from contracting with firms that use prison labor.
Former President Ronald Reagan's busting of the National Air Traffic Controllers Union during the early 1980s is coming back to haunt the Federal Aviation Administration. The FAA projects more than 7,000 of the nation's 15,000 air traffic controllers will become eligible to retire over the next decade, and it has no substantive plan to replace them. Many of those set to retire are the replacements of those union controllers fired en masse by Reagan in 1982.
George W. Bush's 2004 re-election campaign broke the president's own sanctions against one of the world's most repressive regimes recently, when it sold garments produced in the military dictatorship of Burma. A fleece pullover bearing the logo Bush Cheney 04 retailed for $49.95 on the website of the campaign to re-elect the president. According to the National Labor Committee, Burmese textile workers would have to work 713 hours in order to afford a Bush Cheney pullover.
For the last several months, the British government's been mulling over an overhaul of the civil service workforce. Key to the plan was the moving of 20,000 London area government jobs to regional offices. The proposal would save the government money by not having to pay for the higher cost of living in London. But the scope of the plan has now been dramatically expanded. As many as 20,000 jobs will still move from London, while another 65,000 now are targeted for dismissal, all within the next 4 years. British public sector unions call the move irresponsible, not only because of the radically reduced services that will result, but also because of the expected collapse in morale among the government workforce.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to Solutions for Progress Incorporated, American workers are 81% more productive today than they were in 1968, and corporate profits are 39% higher when adjusted for inflation. But minimum wage workers earn nearly 40% less than their counterparts did a generation ago. The lowest paid workers received $1.65 an hour in 1968, the equivalent of $8.45 in 2003. You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The best of the rest of the news, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Turn down the bed.
Welcome to the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Tom Hartman here with you. This legislation that is before the House and the Senate right now, this is fascinating. Not only does it add women to the draft between the ages of 18 and 26, but according to a press release, the bill will allow the U.S. government to add 500,000 troops or more within a period of 6 months or less from the date it is signed and approved. And it's timed so that the draft could begin in the early spring of 2005, just after the 2004 presidential election. Interesting times. Interesting times we live in. I believe I mentioned this about Gorbachev. It's worth repeating. Former president, former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev has described the U.S.-led war. This is an article from Agence France-Presse, has described the U.S.-led war in Iraq as a great mistake that increased the risk of terrorist attacks. Invading Iraq was, he said, a great mistake that led to more terrorism and not the prevention of this scourge. It's a verbatim quote from Mr. Gorbachev. He went on to say, democracy cannot be achieved by military force. He said, every day we witness the consequences of the erroneous invasion of Iraq. He said, democracy is not imposed with tanks and missiles, but with respect of other peoples and international law. This, from the man who led his country through a transition into the early stages of democracy. He went on to say, the war has also wounded our relations with our allies, our traditional allies. He said, and I quote, nobody doubts the economic, military, and democratic power of the United States. We recognize this, and that Washington can be a world leader. But we do not believe in leadership through domination. There is no other path than through the respect of international law and cooperation, Gorbachev said. Anything else would be a great danger to the rest of the world. See, this is how it it comes back to haunt you. I mean, from when the founders of this nation 227 years ago first sat down and decided to declare themselves separate from Great Britain, after hostilities had already commenced, and they gathered together in Philadelphia to write the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson being the principal author of it, and the primary editors after he wrote the first draft being John Adams, Ben Franklin, and either John Jay or George Mason, I forget which. I think it was Mason. And they knew at that time, 227 years ago, that it is simply wrong for a nation to attack another nation, or to declare war on another nation, or to declare hostilities or commence hostilities with another nation, if they haven't been provoked, if they haven't been attacked first. This is not a new idea. This is something that goes back, well, thousands of years. And so they attached to the Declaration of Independence a bill of particulars, it was called, a list of here's the ways that essentially we were attacked by Great Britain. And, it's still there. You can read it. It's attached to the Declaration of Independence. You know, King George did this, that, and the other thing to us. And they harmed us, and they were attacks upon us, and they denied us sovereignty, and they denied us freedom, and these were oppressions that we can no longer tolerate. And as a consequence of this, we have to declare our independence, realizing that this means war. So from the founding of this country until 1 year ago this week, the policy of the United States has been that we don't attack people unless they attacked us first. Now, there have been times when we finessed it, shall we say. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. LBJ wanted to escalate the war in Vietnam. the what was originally a police action. They phonied up this thing, this attack against one of our ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. Lied about it to Congress. And ultimately, you know, frankly, I it's interesting. You know, it just occurred to me, LBJ was never really held to account for that. And perhaps that's why George Bush thought that he could simply lie about weapons of mass destruction and never be held to account for it. The problem is that LBJ never was in a situation where he had to, he had to hire an inspector to go over to Vietnam and check out the boat. Was there really an attack against us? Did Vietnam really represent a threat to the United States? Well, you know, there was the domino theory back then, the idea that if Vietnam went communist, then so would everybody else, and Japan would be at risk, you know, one of our allies. And it was a theory that I think people of good intent believed was possible. But LBJ's his actual rationalization for the war was based on a lie. But at least, you know, he put it out and he said, well, here's the lie. So George Bush did the same thing. Okay, here's the story, guys. We're going to do this. We haven't been attacked. These guys don't represent a threat to us. But we're going to say that they do. And we're going to make most Americans think that they attacked us. And, you know, George Bush had the bad luck, I guess you could say, of his lie not being a boat in the harbor. You know, the USS Maine down off, as I recall, was it off the coast of San Juan or was it in the Philippines? I don't remember where the USS Maine was, that the boiler exploded and Teddy Roosevelt used it as the excuse to declare the Spanish-American War, in which we took the Philippines and we took Puerto Rico. Back in the first decade of the last century. And the USS Maine just kind of went away. You know, there was no inspectors. The ship in the Gulf of Tonkin just sort of went away. Now, the weapons of mass destruction, Iraq didn't go away. So George Bush, now, John Kerry, it was reported originally, and I don't have the reporter's name here. I wish I did. It's odd. I haven't seen this guy's name in the press at all. If anybody knows it, give me a shout. 1-866-889-8894. I'd like to follow up on it. But anyhow, there's this reporter who reported in the press that in an interview with John Kerry, John Kerry had said to him, there are foreign leaders who say, boy, you've really got to get that guy out of office. We really need a change of administration or something to that effect. And later the reporter went back and checked his tape when this thing turned into a furor. And it turns out that John Kerry didn't say foreign leaders. He said there are more leaders. And, you know, he may well have been referring to people like Jimmy Carter or Ted Kennedy. Or maybe he was referring to foreign leaders. I frankly doubt it, just because I don't think that John Kerry is that dumb a politician. There's a reason why he ended up with the Democratic nomination. Howard Dean put his foot in his mouth, you know, one time too many. Particularly when on the Chris Matthews show he said he'd break up the big media monopolies. I mean, it's just, don't do that. So anyhow, John Kerry, whether he said it or not, the right-wing echo machine of the press made it real for the American people that John Kerry had said it. Now, this is something that goes back, way back. I mean, one of the attacks that Thomas Jefferson unfairly, some would say, many would say, certainly Adams said it, that Thomas Jefferson unfairly used against John Adams in the election of 1800 was that John Adams was secretly a royalist, that he had defended in the Boston Massacre. John Adams had been the lawyer who defended the British soldier that John Adams had had correspondence with people in England, that he was, you know, and Adams had actually written that he was skeptical that democracy was really a viable form of government. And Jefferson brought this out and you know, basically was claiming, or it wasn't Jefferson himself. I mean, it was through his surrogates in the press, Benjamin Franklin Bach with his Aurora and whatnot, basically claiming that was Ben Franklin's grandson, who John Adams later had arrested. but anyway, he was claiming that Adams was buddies with foreign leaders. I mean, ever since the Revolution, Americans have not liked the idea of people, you know, political folks in our political arena getting in tight with the leaders of other nations. So George Bush comes along and says, in really, you know, I mean, this was turning it from a this is when President Bush became Candidate Bush. And, you know, a lot of people figured he would continue to be that he would do a Rose Garden strategy like Nixon did, that he would continue to be President Bush for at least another 3 or 4 months and not, you know, get into the mud of the candidate. I started to say stoop to it, but it's not. I mean, you know, it's campaigning is a noble thing. It is the essence of our democracy. So anyhow, George Bush says to John Kerry, or says to the press, but, you know, says, if you've got foreign leaders who are supporting you, it's time to name names. And I thought that was a particularly interesting comment for George Bush to say, that it was time to name names. Gene Collier wrote an interesting op-ed in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He says, it's time for the president to play the name names game. And he suggests that if George Bush is so committed to naming names, and here are some of the questions. This is just great that Gene Collier, in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, yesterday's paper put out. Here are some of the names that he suggests. He says, who met with Dick Cheney in the first days of this administration to formulate America's energy policy? Name the names. Which corporate titans wielded the key influences that have resulted in the most environmental hostile administration in memory, the highest gas prices in memory, and a myopic oil junkie foreign policy? Name names. He says, that's right, I've got to wait until the Supreme Court rules on that one. Who was on board the notorious Saudi airlift? He says, name names. Who allowed a plane load of influential Saudis to fly out of the country September 13th, 2001, with all commercial air traffic grounded and before any formal investigation of the hijackings fully began? Name names. Who outed Valerie Plame? Name names. Who decided not to allow soldiers returning from Iraq at Walter Reed Hospital to be interviewed by representatives of the disabled American veterans unless a government official was present? Name names, Mr. President. Who directed Thomas Scully, the Medicare administrator, to tell Richard Foster he'd be fired if he didn't withhold the actual cost of the prescription drug benefit package that passed Congress with a $400 billion price tag, but in fact, $130 billion more is going to go from our taxpayer pockets into the hands of the drug companies? Name names. Who is National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice protecting by not testifying publicly before the Independent Commission investigating the 9/11 attacks? Name names. Who came up with the idea for your own testimony before that commission not to exceed 1 hour? Name names. Mr. President, who actually saw you complete your National Guard obligations in Alabama during the Vietnam War? Name names. Who at any level of any government has received any form of discipline, let alone been fired as a direct result of the massive intelligence failures that led to 9/11? Name names. And he goes on. It's an interesting story. Time to name names. 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to be on the program. Ernie in El Paso, Texas. Driving a truck through El Paso, Ernie, are you?
Well, I'm not driving anymore. I'm kind of stuck at the dock, you know.
Okay.
Listening to your program, and, you know, I hate to admit I agree with everything you say, but I think I do.
Yeah.
Except you made a comment Friday that you did not believe that this administration would stoop so low as to plant WMDs in Iraq, and I believe they would. I think they're on the edge. They're in a boat that's fixing to go over the falls, and I don't know of any other way that they would be able to stop that boat unless they do that.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I wouldn't say I don't believe that they would do it. I would consider it really unlikely, and I think it would be a really stupid move for them to do it.
It would be a really stupid move because I believe that some of these wealthy Democratic backers, if they were to put out, say, like a reward for anyone who could prove that they were doing this, or
it would come out. Yeah. So that was the main basis of my comment, Ernie. It wasn't so much that I don't think that these guys are that it's beneath them, because I mean, after what they did with Joe Wilson's wife, I don't think anything's beneath these guys. I just don't think that it would be practical. But and frankly, it would have to be one heck of a weapons cache for it to have any impact now after all this. Ernie, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Tom Hartman. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly, and they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America, Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. Have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
I will, thanks.
Oil took its toll on Alaska's Prince William Sound for years after a disastrous spill. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. 15 years ago this month, the oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground off the shores of Alaska. 11 million gallons of oil leaked out of the ship and covered about 1,300 miles of shoreline. People spent almost 4 years cleaning up the oil, but a new study shows that a lot of it stuck around and caused problems long after cleanup efforts ended. Pete Peterson is a marine biologist at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and he helped write a report on the oil spill that was published in the journal Science. Peterson says a lot of oil washed onto beaches that absorbed it like a sponge. The oil seeped into coarse sediments, and it stayed there. Peterson says it's only natural that the oil could persist for years under those conditions.
After all, think of where oil comes from. Oil comes from subsurface pockets. By putting it under the surface, we are approaching the sort of environment in which oil has remained for many years.
Peterson says that trapped petroleum caused problems for years after the accident. For example, he says it killed the eggs of pink salmon. He says when the eggs survived exposure to the oil and hatched, the fish were often scrawny and had a hard time surviving at sea.
The toxicity from petroleum is not simply, as we had contemplated 2 decades ago, a consequence of acute exposure. Rather, the oil has long-term consequences. What we may have dismissed in the past as insignificant actually translate into loss of animals, loss of abundance, production, and reproductive capacity.
Peterson says that it's hard to tell how long the oil will remain in Prince William Sound, but he says it could linger in some areas for up to 30 years. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson.
Bringing you uncommon sense, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Desperate for changing, starving for truth. Closer to where I started, we're chasing after you. I'm falling even more in love.
And welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to be on the air, Florence in Grand Rapids, Michigan is on. Hey, Florence, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm calling because I loved your rant on name names.
Thank you. Actually, I can't take credit for it. It was Gene Collier who came up with the idea in the Pittsburgh Post Gazette.
He did good. I just thought maybe we could get our vice president, who's in hiding most of the time, to name some names.
Well, I have a feeling he's going to be trotted out from hiding, probably today or tomorrow, on various right wing shows or in the news media to try and obfuscate. I mean, he does a very good job of that. He's one of the few who is still repeating things that have been largely discredited by everybody else.
I just wonder how many people listen to that garbage.
Well, a lot. A lot.
I'm afraid,
you know,
I just wanted to tell you that, talk about naming names. He hasn't named names that have been on his energy.
Yeah.
Meeting.
Yeah.
We had this group had to go to the Supreme Court to get him to try and name names.
Yep. Yep, and it's still before the Supreme Court, and this is a really serious issue, too, because,
I know.
I mean, not only does it have to do with whether or not our attacking Iraq had to do with our energy policy, and increasingly it looks like it did, number one, and I would have had a problem if he came to the American people and he said, hey, you know, we consume 25% of the world's oil, and 10% of the world's, and 50% of the oil that we consume is imported into the United States. We only have enough to supply half of our own needs, and Iraq has 10% of the world's oil. We want to go and invade them. Let's have a discussion. You know, that would be a rational debate. I mean, let's be honest about things and debate them. And maybe he could have even made a case that we should go in and say to the Iraqi people, hey, we'll help you overthrow your dictator if you'll let us have your oil. You know,
well,
or something,
you know,
like that.
I have one thing to say. I think that they think the American people are just nothing but a bunch of stupid people.
Well, we will find out in November.
That they can pull around by the nose and push them into things. And that's what happens when you isolate yourself from the people.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a startling degree of isolation there. Florence, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. Great to hear from Grand Rapids. 1-866-889-8894. Well, we're at the end of the hour here. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
At the range of the machinery for change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family is broken and it's
critics hear the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it? So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
You lost me.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Jobs lost, 2.4 million. Federal deficit, $455 billion. War in Iraq, 9,000 human lives. Friends left at the United Nations, three. America's future, bankrupt.
The time is now.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Don Waller in New York. George W. Bush ignored the threat of al-Qaeda for months and did too little to stop the September 11th attacks on the United States, a former administration counterterrorism official said Sunday. Richard Clark's accusations, aired in a CBS 60 Minutes interview, drew a detailed point-by-point rebuttal from the White House as it attempted to defend Bush's standing as a presidential candidate who was tough on terrorism. In the program on his book to be launched Monday, Clark charged that Bush had done a terrible job in addressing the threat from terrorism. Former President Jimmy Carter has strongly criticized George Bush and Tony Blair for waging an unnecessary war to oust Saddam Hussein based on lies or misinterpretations. The 2002 Nobel Peace Prize winner said Mr. Blair had allowed his better judgment to be swayed by Mr. Bush's desire to finish a war that his father had started. In an interview with the British newspaper The Independent on the first anniversary of the American and British invasion of Iraq, Carter said the Iraq war was based on lies and misinterpretations from London and from Washington, claiming falsely that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the 9/11 attacks and claiming falsely that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Reports that led to charges against six U.S. soldiers accused of abusing detainees at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison came from within the military, not from prisoner complaints, a senior U.S. military official said Sunday. The soldiers, members of a military police unit, were charged Saturday with a range of crimes including conspiracy, dereliction of duty, cruelty and maltreatment, assault, and indecent acts with another person. The military said about 20 detainees at the prison on the western outskirts of Baghdad were involved. Israel killed Hamas founder Ahmed Yassin in a helicopter missile strike outside a Gaza City mosque Monday, prompting threats of unprecedented revenge by Palestinian militants against Israel and the United States. Yassin was the most prominent Palestinian leader killed by Israel in more than 3 years of fighting, and his assassination was seen as a major escalation. More Minuteman News after this.
I'm Oscar Davis. You may have a serious eye condition and not even know it. Vision loss is not a normal part of aging. Some vision changes are normal. Some are due to eye disease. Do you know the difference? Open your eyes to the facts. To get more information about vision and aging, or find out about what help is available if you're having vision problems, call Lighthouse International at 1-800-829-0500 or visit www.lighthouse.org.
A West Virginia man accused of robbing a convenience store left a big clue behind for investigators, his wallet. Terry Lee Romine of Hansford was charged with robbing the V-Mart in Comfort, West Virginia, Friday morning. He allegedly ordered a slice of pizza and then demanded cash from the clerk, saying he had a gun. As he fled, the clerk looked down and saw the man's wallet on the counter. For the Minuteman News Service, this is Don Waller in New York.
Minuteman Newsbreak is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
I have exciting news for those of you who worry that American industry is losing its creative edge. America West Airlines has just implemented a stunning innovation that is certain to revive this sagging industry and assure profits, new jobs, and happy skies as far as the horizon extends. The innovation? Ads on tray tables. Yes, just when you thought that surely there was not another space left anywhere in our country for corporations to put more ads, along comes America West to slap you right in the face with an ad every time you flip down your tray table on one of its flights. The airline is selling ads to cover every tray top on each of its planes, and it already has Visa, Mercedes-Benz, and Bank of America on board for this flighty idea. Advertisers pay $3,300 per plane to hawk their stuff via tray tables to what they call a captive audience. Indeed, an audience literally strapped to its seats. Tray tables are said to be the brainstorm of marketeer Nick Pagic. Seems more like a slight breeze than a brainstorm to me, but this is what passes for innovation in corporate America today. Pagic gushes that ads on tray tops will, quote, be one of the most powerful and influential media. Oh, sure, I'm going to rush off the plane and buy a Mercedes because of an ad on my tray table. No wonder our economy is in trouble. If you think you can escape by flying on some other carrier, America West marketing honcho warns that it seems to be a no-brainer for other airlines to follow suit once we've blazed the trail. It's enough to make you reach for the barf bag. They admit the tray table ads are just a start as airlines seek other ways to jack up their revenues. Yeah, why not run a constant stream of ads over the PA system, or start charging for pillows, or assessing a fee for those who want to have an oxygen mask available to them? This is Jim Hightower saying, or here's a loopy idea. Why not improve service so flying becomes a pleasant experience rather than an ordeal?
I'll just see who that is then.
Oh no! South American killer bees! They're going for my eye!
A swarm of killer bees. That's one thing you don't want in your house. One thing you do want in your house is a better-looking roof with Plitanium plywood from Georgia-Pacific. Other roof sheathing materials can swell at the edges, creating an unsightly checkerboard pattern under your shingles. Plitanium roofs provide a more uniform surface. Plitanium plywood. Build it better.
Wow, that's hot.
I think it's cool.
At that speed, definitely hot.
I don't see it that way.
I forgot. You're more right brain.
Right. 24 prints a minute. That's cool.
In black and white or color?
Cool.
For under $1,000.
Cool.
From Xerox?
Really cool.
Sorry, 24 color pages a minute is nothing but hot.
You think anything that's fast is hot?
That's cold.
The new Xerox Phaser 8400, the world's fastest office color printer for under $1,000. To find out how
cool
hot
it really is, visit Xerox.com/office.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, high up in the Green Mountains of the People's Republic of Vermont. Tom Hartman with you. Before 9/11, did the White House know that something was up? After 9/11, both President Bush and his top national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, denied having any prior knowledge that Al-Qaeda was planning an attack involving airplanes. You remember this? I mean, this was National Security Advisor Rice, on May 16th of 02, said, and I quote, "I don't think anybody could have predicted that they would try to use an airplane as a missile or a hijacked airplane as a missile," end quote. Similarly, President Bush denied having any idea about the threat, saying on May 17th, the next day, George Bush said, quote, "Had I known that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning, I would have done everything in my power to protect the American people." So we have Rice, who is refusing to testify before the 9/11 Commission, saying to the news media, well, I don't think anybody could have predicted that they would try to use an airplane. And we have the next day the President of the United States saying the same thing. Let's examine the record. Before we do that, though, Israel's on the line, driving a truck through New York City, I believe. Hey, Israel, welcome to the Tom Harbin program.
You had a good weekend, I hope.
Oh, yeah. How about you?
Yeah. On the weekend, I drove this weekend, and my wife was with me listening to Sirius, and now she make me put another one in her car that she'll take it home to listen to
the
house.
That's great.
One thing, it's the election now, there's not the election only for the presidency. There's also very important, I think, that people will know, so to the Senate and the House that's coming up.
Well, and they're even actually more important than the election for president. I mean, the president has the bully pulpit, but the House of Representatives has the power to appropriate money, and the Senate has the ability to confirm judges and to cancel out or go along with the actions of the House. So those are the important
ones. I don't hear the DNC doing anything to put down what they're standing for, what the Republicans standing for. I don't know if you can call them Republican anymore. They're not Republican or no, neither conservative. They are the new royal standing for. I mean, because that's what it is. It's a new power to be and the destruction of the way you describe the middle class. And except, I must say, except you and maybe another one or two talk show hosts that also you got a great website, by the way.
Thank you.
And I don't see anybody talking about it at all. I mean, they don't bring the information to the public at all. I mean,
well, I think more and more people are going to be, and I think, you know, people are starting to wake up to it. But the larger issue that you raise about the DNC not defining their positions, I think the reason for that in this election anyway, it would be different in the midterm election, but the reason for that is that the party platform has not been put together. That's put together at the convention. And ultimately it has to be something that's agreed upon by the presidential candidate. So they're not yet in a position to say, okay, here are the things that we stand for, this is our agenda, this is what we're all about, because they just got a candidate, John Kerry. And in theory, they still don't even have a candidate because there are still primary elections to come, and they haven't had their conference yet, their convention yet. So I think that's why.
I would like to see also John Kerry coming out and defining more of himself. I know what he stands for, and if I put him against the current president on any issue, I mean, from record, from service record, the military, or the way he supported the debate, on anything else that he put in, I mean, he's my guy. But if he won't put himself out, I mean, the Republican will define him for the public.
Yeah, you know, Israel.
He needs to go out. He needs to go out and start putting himself out more and more. I mean, yeah. I heard only, I think, one advertisement from John Kerry.
Part of the problem is that he doesn't have any money. I mean, you know, he's George Bush has raised $150 million so far and spent about $20 million or $30 million of it, and John Kerry has raised maybe $6 or $8 million, and he's out of cash. But the other thing is, I absolutely agree with you, and I think that Walter Cronkite wrote a brilliant op-ed piece that was reprinted on Common Dreams this weekend, where he said that back in the election of 88, George Bush Sr. Attacked Michael Dukakis as being a liberal and a card-carrying member of the ACLU. And Dukakis refused to defend himself. He didn't come back and say, yes, I am, and I'm proud of it. Instead, he tried to, you know, change the topic. And that was a terrible mistake. And Walter Cronkite is saying to John Kerry, okay, they're going to call you a liberal, and they're going to call you a card-carrying member of the ACLU, and you need to say, yes, I am a liberal. I'm in favor of Social Security. I'm in favor of Medicare. I'm in favor of strong public education for our children. I'm in favor of a social safety net. I'm in favor of a strong national defense. I'm in favor of minimum wage laws. I'm in favor of unionization rights across the country. I'm in favor of there being a strong middle class. Yes, I am a liberal. I'm in favor of internationalism rather than unilateralism. That is, you know, involving ourselves in the world community rather than just going things alone. Yes, I'm a liberal. I'm proud to say it and to say that I am not a conservative. And John Kerry needs to say that, Walter Cronkite said. And I agree with him.
Okay.
And it sounds like that's what you're saying too, Israel. Yeah, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good point. Good point. So anyhow, let's get back to this 9/11 timeline, and this is just remarkable. We go back to 1999. Now, keep in mind, the setup for this, the predicate of this, is that both Condoleezza Rice and George Bush said that they didn't, they had no idea that anybody would try to hijack an airplane and use it as a missile. Condi Rice saying, quote, "I don't think anybody could have predicted that they would try to use an airplane as a missile, a hijacked airplane as a missile," on May 16th of 02. And the day later, May 17th of 02, the president, George Bush, George W. Bush, saying, had I known that the government, that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning, I would have done everything in my power to protect the American people. So we go back to 1990. An explicit warning. This is, by the way, I'm sharing this with you. It's a report produced by the Center for American Progress. Excellent report. You can find it on their website, AmericanProgress.org. 1999, a report prepared by the Library of Congress for the National Intelligence Council, quote, warned that Osama bin Laden's terrorists could hijack an airliner and fly it into government buildings like the Pentagon, end quote. This was in 1999. Bill Clinton was still president. This information got acted on. It's in large part how they stopped the bombing of the Los Angeles airport a year later. And it got passed along to George Bush, according to Sandy Berger, Condoleezza Rice's equivalent. And we'll find out. I mean, Bill Clinton, I believe, is going to testify before the 9/11 Commission this week. It's going to be fascinating. The report specifically said, and I quote, "Suicide bombers belonging to Al-Qaeda's Martyrdom Battalion could crash land an aircraft packed with high explosives into the Pentagon, the headquarters of the CIA, or the White House," end quote. In response to the ominous warnings, the New York Times reports, quote, "Under Janet Reno, the Justice Department's counterterrorism budget increased 13.6% in the fiscal year 1999, 7.1% in 2000, and 22.7% in 2001. And then, of course, George Bush became president, and they said, Al-Qaeda? That's not, you know, according to Richard Clark, that's not a risk. That's nothing to worry about. Early 2001. Now George Bush is president. In late spring 2001, a sudden surge in activity began among known Al-Qaeda operatives. A reporter from Middle East Broadcasting visited bin Laden's camp in Afghanistan and noted that his supporters were preparing for attacks against American interests. At the same time, now early 2001, White House departs from efforts to track terrorist money. The new Bush Treasury Department, quote, disapproved of the Clinton administration's approach to money laundering issues, which had been an important part of the drive to cut off the flow of money to bin Laden, end quote. Specifically, the Bush administration opposed Clinton administration-backed efforts by the G7 and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development that targeted countries with, quote, loose banking regulations, end quote, being abused by terrorist financiers. Remember this? I remember this quite clearly because the conflict around it, the debate and dispute around this, that George Bush was undoing the money laundering laws that had been put into place by Bill Clinton, was not framed at the time in the context of terrorism. It was framed in the context of George Bush is trying to loosen the rules so that his corporate crony buddies and the marginally legal people that his family does business with, like the BCCI people, the Ahmed Chalabi people, he's, you know, the convicted bank swindler who's now, you know, receiving a third of $1 million every month from the Pentagon for being our guy in Iraq, the guy who fed us all this intelligence. That Bush didn't want these guys to be prosecuted or to get in trouble or to be under pressure. I mean, that was the discussion back then, was that the Bush family was involved with some business folks who had marginally legal interests. So meanwhile, the Bush administration provided, quote, no funding for the new terrorist asset tracking center, end quote. July of 2001. And keep in mind, You know, after 9/11, George Bush says, had I known that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning, I would have done anything in my, everything in my power to protect the American people. July of 2001, the L.A. Times reported that U.S. and Italian officials were warned in July 2001 that, quote, Islamic terrorists might attempt, this is from the Los Angeles Times, Islamic, July of 2001, before 9/11, quote, Islamic terrorists might attempt to kill President Bush and other leaders by crashing an airliner into the Genoa summit of industrialized nations. Oh, but we had no idea that they would ever use an airplane. July of 2001, John Ashcroft stops flying on commercial airplanes because of a threat assessment. Attorney General John Ashcroft stopped flying commercial airlines and instead began traveling, here's a quote, traveling exclusively, this is from CBS, on July 26th of 01, quote, CBS News reporting, John Ashcroft is now, quote, traveling exclusively by leased jet aircraft instead of commercial airlines because of what the Justice Department called a threat assessment. That threat assessment has never been made public. Never been made public. Why was John Ashcroft afraid to get on an airplane, and why didn't he protect us? 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
In my country, a group of religious extremists are reshaping the government to promote their own agenda and morality.
The government can keep a list of everyone I call, and they do not need a judge's permission.
Our citizens are seized and held in prison without being charged of a crime, without the right to a trial, and without a lawyer. Why should you care about what is happening to my country? Because my country is the United States of America.
We'll take care of her. Got my best man, Dick, looking at it now.
George Bush says he is fighting terrorism. What does he do? Cut funding for first responders. He says he is for education. What does he do? Underfund his own plan. He says he supports our veterans. What does he do? Cut funding for their health care. George Bush said he'd restore honor and integrity to the White House. It's not what you say, George. It's what you do.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the Tune Tracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is rock solid. It has not burped one single time. This thing has not stopped. And I tell you, I've got some software that I run at two of my other radio stations that cost tons and tons more. One I paid, I think, $1,500 for it. And then one system, which was the Arrakis DigiLink system, I paid $15,000 for it. But this rivals my $15,000 system.
As Mike Chandler said, the Tune Tracker system is rock solid. And the price? Only $349.95 for the Pro version with traffic interface and only $149.95 for the original Tune Tracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation system that performs like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.tunetrackersystems.com. www.tunetrackersystems.com.
The best of the rest of the news. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Tom Hartman radio program here with you. Okay, we're looking at before 9/11 and what was known. And we have George W. Bush saying on May 17th of 02, you know, after 9/11, 6 months, 8 months after 9/11, he says, "Had I known that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning, I would have done everything in my power to protect the American people." Condi Rice the day before saying, "I don't think anybody could have predicted that they would try to use an airplane as a missile, a hijacked airplane as a missile." Now, what are your thoughts on this, by the way? 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. One of those newfangled toll-free numbers, 1-866-889-8894. So John Ashcroft stops flying in July of 2001. On August of 2001, the president is personally warned of an Al-Qaeda airline plot. ABC News reported this. Not a secret. Bush administration, this is a quote from Dateline ABC. "Officials acknowledge that U.S. intelligence officials informed President Bush weeks before the September 11 attacks that bin Laden's terrorist network might try to hijack American planes." They went on to report that on August 6th of 2001, a month before 9/11, the president personally, quote, "received a one-and-a-half-page briefing advising him that Osama bin Laden was capable of a major strike against the U.S. and that the plot could include the hijacking of an American airplane." The source, NBC News. And here we have George Bush saying, "Had I known that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning, I would have done everything in my power to protect the American people." Well, he certainly protected Ashcroft and Rice and Bush and Cheney. September 2001, on the day before 9/11, Newsweek reported that on 9/10/01, quote, "A group of top Pentagon officials suddenly canceled travel plans for the next morning, apparently because of security concerns." Newsweek also reported that, quote, "As many as 10 to 12 warnings were issued before 9/11, and more than two of the warnings specifically mentioned the possibility of hijackings." Now, moving along to reducing counterterrorism, the federal government was rapidly increasing its counterterrorism efforts at the time President Bush took office. I mean, Bill Clinton had been just cranking this thing up. As the New York Times reported, Attorney General Janet Reno ended her tenure as perhaps the strongest advocate of counterterrorism spending. Similarly, Newsweek and the Washington Post reported the National Security Advisor Sandy Berger was totally preoccupied with the prospect of a domestic terror attack, telling his replacements that they needed to, quote, "be spending more time on this issue," end quote, "than on any other." But when the Bush administration took office, things suddenly changed. They, for example, moved their law enforcement efforts away from counterterrorism. The New York Times reported that in the lead up to 9/11, Attorney General John Ashcroft said, quote, fighting terrorism was a top priority of his agency, yet upon entering office, quote, he identified more than a dozen other objectives for greater emphasis within the Justice Department before the 9/11 attacks. On August 9th, the administration distributed a strategic plan to the Justice Department highlighting its new goals from a list of Clinton administration goals. The item that referred to intelligence and investigation of terrorists was left unhighlighted. So Clinton's going nuts trying to find the terrorists. He's got this plan to get bin Laden after the USS Cole has been bombed. He stops a terrorist incident in L.A. airport. They know that Al-Qaeda is coming. They tell the Bush administration about it. And John Ashcroft decides it's more important to go after people who are selling bongs. Real important stuff. This is the Tom Hartman Program, 29 minutes past the hour. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Kids across America are digging deep. President Bush's tax cuts mean big tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires. Paying for them won't be easy, but these kids are ready to do their part. In 2003 alone, George Bush put every child in America $7,400 into debt. To these children, we have one thing to say.
Thanks, kids.
Easily paid for by billionaires for Bush.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell signed an executive order last week at the AFL-CIO's 36th Constitutional Convention prohibiting state contracts from going to sweatshop apparel or laundry companies. Any industry signing a contract with the state must prove they pay their employees an hourly rate at least equivalent to the poverty threshold and provide working conditions meeting or exceeding the International Labor Organization's convention's rules, governing wage and hour laws, forced labor, child labor, occupational health and safety, and non-discrimination. However, the order doesn't ban the state from contracting with firms that use prison labor.
Former President Ronald Reagan's busting of the National Air Traffic Controllers Union during the early 1980s is coming back to haunt the Federal Aviation Administration. The FAA projects more than 7,000 of the nation's 15,000 air traffic controllers will become eligible to retire over the next decade, and it has no substantive plan to replace them. Many of those set to retire are the replacements of those union controllers fired en masse by Reagan in 1982.
George W. Bush's 2004 re-election campaign broke the president's own sanctions against one of the world's most repressive regimes recently, when it sold garments produced in the military dictatorship of Burma. A fleece pullover bearing the logo Bush Cheney 04 retailed for $49.95 on the website of the campaign to re-elect the president. According to the National Labor Committee, Burmese textile workers would have to work 713 hours in order to afford a Bush-Cheney pullover.
For the last several months, the British government's been mulling over an overhaul of the civil service workforce. Key to the plan was the moving of 20,000 London area government jobs to regional offices. The proposal would save the government money by not having to pay for the higher cost of living in London. But the scope of the plan has now been dramatically expanded. As many as 20,000 jobs will still move from London, while another 65,000 now are targeted for dismissal, all within the next 4 years. British public sector unions call the move irresponsible, not only because of the radically reduced services that will result, but also because of the expected collapse in morale among the government workforce.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to Solutions for Progress Incorporated, American workers are 81% more productive today than they were in 1968, and corporate profits are 39% higher when adjusted for inflation. But minimum wage workers earn nearly 40% less than their counterparts did a generation ago. The lowest paid workers received $1.65 an hour in 1968, the equivalent of $8.45 in 2003. You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
bringing you uncommon sense. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Show a little passion, baby.
Sinclair Evans of Peril. We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
And welcome back. 26 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The radio support group of, by, and for we the people, the rest of America. Yes, indeed. A program that goes beyond just the right wing nuts. Oh, what a marvelous day. It's a beautiful sunny day here in central Vermont, up in the Green Mountains here. Yesterday I saw a fox go by. It's running on the hillside across from the house. The groundhog hole is not yet, I don't know if he's not woken up yet or if he's moved, but built a big house there in the middle of Louise's garden, and we decided that he was here before we were, or his relatives were, so we just let him be there. But he hasn't come out yet. I don't know. Maybe they just move around. Anyhow, 25 minutes before the hour, we're looking at 9/11 and this administration's response to it, or lack thereof. 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to be on the program and share your thoughts on this with us. Andy in Massachusetts is on the line. Hey, Andy, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello from Kerry Country. How you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Oh, not much. Now, one thing I haven't heard you mention, I got in the car about 45 minutes ago, I haven't heard you mention this yet. Does everyone know where Bush was when Al-Qaeda was sowing the final seeds of 9/11?
After he got his threat assessment, he took the longest vacation in the history of the presidency in Texas. And then,
that's what I was getting at.
And then when that was over, he still didn't want to go back to Washington, D.C., so he went to Florida. And
right.
And then, you know, he made this amazing remark on TV, and he's repeated it twice now that I know of, where he said he watched the 9/11 attacks on TV from that school in Florida, when in fact the videotape of it didn't appear until the next day. So, you know, it's you have to wonder if it just kind of, you know, line as a way of life with him, or did he hallucinate it, or did he just, you know, was it another I'm just baffled by that.
Well, you know what they say about liars. When they're selling up them, they start to believe them.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
one thing, though, that...
It's a sad thing, though.
Thing
you know?
I haven't heard mentioned yet was that several of, I believe, CIA or FBI agents out in Utah, if I'm not mistaken, had brought to the president's attention, as well as Condi and everybody else, that there were several Middle Eastern students who were taking flight lessons but had absolutely no interest in either learning how to take off or land.
Yeah, well, they were trying to get that up to Ashcroft, and that was the kind of stuff. Did you see the 60 Minutes thing last night?
I watched a good deal of it. I couldn't stand watching the guy who's essentially a Bush yes man, terrible glasses. Can't remember the guy's
yeah.
name.
Yeah, Stephen Hedrick, I think it is.
Yes.
Yeah, he's Condi's assistant, and he's the guy who was also briefed on the way in. Yeah, well, toward the end of that interview, Richard Clark made an interesting observation broadly about those things, and you know, saying that when Clinton learned that Al-Qaeda was going to attack the United States, and they had a spectacular attack planned for the Los Angeles airport. I mean, you know, you blow up, you know, you get all these airplanes that are just wingtip to wingtip, you know, and you blow up one of those things, and 20 airplanes would go up in flames, and each one might have 200-300 people in it, you know, and it's just mind-boggling to even think about what it would have been like. And when he learned that they were going to try and do something like this, he put the White House on what he called battle station, and literally every single day required the president of the FBI and the head of the CIA to report to him what they had learned from their people. And so he had Janet Reno. I mean, her budget went up 17% that year. She was digging down deep and finding information, and that's what led to capturing this guy. Well, when Bush comes in, He says, we don't have to worry about this stuff. You know, it's life's good. Be happy. Don't worry. You know, and Cheney is, you know, in the, off in the corner hatching plans with the oil industry executives to take Iraq and divide it up. And Bush is, and John Ashcroft is concerned about whether or not the breast of the statue in the Justice Department is exposed, and whether or not the Cheech and Chong are out there selling bongs on the internet, and so you know, I mean, this was the failure, I think, and that came out toward the end of that interview, and that was one of those real kind of jaw dropping moments for me.
Right. I mean, the whole thing to me just seemed as if Bush never wanted to admit, or in that case, anybody in his cabinet wanted to admit that Clinton was right about something.
Well, and that's that. You know, in their defense, to some extent, that's a political imperative. I mean, it's
right.
It's suicide. It's political suicide to say I was wrong, because then for right or wrong, I mean, I think it's dumb. But for right or wrong, the people start thinking, well, geez, if he was wrong about that, maybe he'd be wrong about other things, and we can't have somebody who's ever wrong. I mean, you got to have somebody infallible in charge. And
yeah.
So, you know, it's a bizarre psychology. I mean, we all know it's the wrong thing, and yet that's how we react.
Right.
But they're not going to admit that they were wrong. I mean, it's short of resigning. And even after Nixon resigned, he never admitted he was wrong. I mean, we never got an apology out of Richard Nixon.
All and we that's what we're turning into right now. A country divided by party, and the whole thing just, you know, reeks of Nixon, when Nixon was in charge.
There you go. Andy, thanks for the call. I appreciate
it.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8899, 420 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeff from Denver's on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Calling from Denver, where we're having those temperatures unaffected by global climate change of nearly 80 degrees all week, and all the ski areas are losing all their snow.
That's interesting. It's really cold here, actually. It was down in the 20s last night. I don't think it got above 30 today, but it's supposed to warm up this weekend here in Vermont.
Well, even the highest town in the country, Leadville, Colorado, has temperatures all in the mid-50s this week. And
that's
so the ski areas at the similar altitudes are all just losing their snow immediately.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it's awful. But one thing I'd like to point out is look how many insiders from both Bush and Blair, the Blair administration, are coming out and saying things. I mean, we've got Clark, we've got Wilson, who was an insider at some point. We have O'Neill. Claire Short and Robin Cook didn't have anything to gain by resigning their position.
No, in fact, it devastated them, both of them. I mean, it destroyed them.
Yeah.
It destroyed them to do it.
Yeah, so we've got to look at people losing by speaking up. And so I think you need to trust people like that quite a bit, and there's so many. And then, as Leslie Stahl last night pointed out, too, that there were two other insiders, one who was a witness of the meeting with Clark and Bush.
Yeah.
So there are other people that are, you know, speaking more more subtly right now.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting is there were two stories about this in the New York Times today, and the one by Judith Miller, who was the person who passed along the phony intelligence from Chalabee, in the front pages of the New York Times and kind of helped whip up a war fervor in the United States. And she has never been called to account for that, to the best of my knowledge, and it concerns me. The story by her started out, the main lead of it seemed to me, anyway, was the administration's rebuttal, the fact that this guy is doing it during a political time, that he's got a book to sell, you know, the standard shtick of, you know, don't attack the message, attack the messenger. And then she got into the message toward the end. Whereas there was another story in the New York Times that did a more detailed and thorough job of examining it. But it just, you know, it concerned me. But, you know, anyhow, yeah, Claire Short in particular really, really took a hit there.
If you look at Robin Cook, I mean, he was essentially the equivalent of Colin Powell. This is a pretty person pretty high up in the administration.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got to start listening. I mean, we've got to get other people to start listening and realize it's a lot of people are saying this.
Yeah, I agree. Jeff, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, and Ed in Dayton, Ohio is on the line. Hey, Ed, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hello. I've been following your conversation about the preparation that was going on to deal with the war on terrorism by the Bush White House and all the things that Condoleezza Rice has said about all the hard work they were doing to deal with terrorists.
Well, actually, she was saying we had no idea. I mean, she's
Well, it's interesting. Bush must be the most efficient president ever because if you take away the 42% of the days of his presidency that he spent in Kennebunkport or at the ranch at out in Crawford or at Camp David, you know, that leaves 58% of the time that he was working. I think if most people did that, they'd be fired.
Now, and of that 58%, I wonder what percentage of it he was on the road raising $1 million a night.
Yeah, who knows? You know, that I'm only talking about the days that he spent either on the way to or at one of those three locations, Camp David, Kennebunkport, or mostly Crawford.
That's interesting. Where'd you get the stat from, Ed?
I got that from an article written by Mike Allen in the Washington Post that was published on August 7th, 2001.
Hmm.
And that was right when he was getting ready for that extra long vacation of that you were describing.
That, right, that led right up to 9/11.
Just before 9/11.
Yeah. Remarkable.
And that you know, it said, you know, let's see, by the time Bush returns to Washington on Labor Day after the longest presidential vacation in 32 years, he will have spent all or part of 54 days since the inauguration at his parched but beloved ranch.
Yes.
That was
his parched but beloved ranch that he bought just when he decided to run for the presidency.
Yeah, because, well, you know Jim Hightower calls it the ranchette because it's really a big photo op.
Right, and you know, because he's afraid of horses, there's no horses there. And it's,
yeah.
Anyway.
No horses and probably no cattle either.
Yeah. Yeah, the ranch.
So anyway, I just want to point out, you know, so if it's really true what Condi Rice is saying about all this hard work, you know, the efficiency must have been absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah, must have been.
That's really all I called about.
Okay.
I just wanted to mention that article and that statistic.
Okay, well, Ed, thank you very much. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. It's 15 minutes before the hour. You're listening to the Tom Hartman radio program, broadcasting live coast-to-coast on radio stations from coast-to-coast, border-to-border on the Sirius satellite, and streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, the member-supported internet radio station, www.radiopower.org. Ray in Bend, Oregon is on the line. Hey, Ray, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk with you again.
Well, thanks for calling.
We were discussing the Condi Rice not possibly knowing that a plane could have struck a building, and I decided that there was something in the past that jogged my memory on this. And it was an item at the Memory Hole, which is on the Internet, thememoryhole.org.
Yeah, it's a great archive.
And it is fabulous. And this is just a little snippet here from the National Law Enforcement and Security Institute conference. This was held in September of 2002. In their promotional literature, they say this, and this is a quote, "On the morning of September 11, 2001, Mr. Fulton and his team at the CIA were running a pre-planned simulation to explore the emergency response issues that would be created if a plane were to strike a building."
Yeah, you know, I remember that, and I remember thinking at the time that I learned of that, which was about a year after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
that might explain why they didn't scramble those planes out of Andrews Air Force Base and the other locations around there to intercept, you know, particularly after the first plane hit the tower, because they all thought that it was a simulation.
Well, on the same day, we had the other anomalies where NORAD was engaged in a major a battle scenario or a planning op, as well as FEMA actually showed up on the night of September 10th, Monday evening. FEMA was in town.
It's being the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Federal Emergency Management Agency was in New York City for a planned simulation emergency response that was occurring on the 11th.
Yeah, now on the one hand, you've got some conspiracy theorists who look at those details,
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, interesting, they knew 9/11 was going to happen, and they were going to make sure that it happened well, and they were going to be, you know, deal with the disaster and all that kind of. And on the other hand, you've got conspiracy theorists on the other end of the spectrum saying, well, the government was really, you know, trying to get their act together and trying to get ready for this because they knew that something might happen. And I wonder who leaked to Al-Qaeda the fact that these three agencies would be involved in this, or at least two of the agencies, NORAD and the whoever was running the air defenses, who leaked this to Osama bin Laden so he picked this particular day so that there wouldn't be planes scrambled.
Let me triangulate this for you. Let's go to the other, the third corner here, and say who would know of all of these preparations that were going on. There is some coordination among intelligence agencies across the planet, and so other intelligence agencies would be aware.
Right, like the one in Pakistan.
Sure. Or, for instance, the one over in the Middle East whose motto is, by means of deception, thou shalt wage war.
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
That's the Israeli secret police. Mossad.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I frankly would be far more suspicious of the guy who was in charge of the Pakistani intelligence service.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you know...
Well, there is the...
And the reason why
that,
is because he's the one who tipped off bin Laden.
He sent $100,000 to Mohammed Atta in the weeks prior.
Not only that, a year earlier when Bill Clinton tried to kill bin Laden with a missile, and remember, and all the right-wing nuts, all the guys on all the right-wing talk show hosts were going, oh, It's wag the Monica, they called it. I think that
mm-hmm.
that was a phrase
mm-hmm.
that Limbaugh invented. It's wag the Monica. He's, you know, he's sending missiles over there to Afghanistan to get some kooky Arab guy, and he's just doing this to divert our attention from Monica Gate. What we really need to know about is what he was doing in the White House, you know, and all, you know, this kind of stuff. And it turns out that the reason that the missiles missed killing bin Laden is that bin Laden got about a 30-minute advance warning that he was going to be attacked, apparently, by the head of Pakistani intelligence.
It's a deep and murky world.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed it is.
Okay.
Ray, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Tom Hartman program, 10 minutes before the hour. The place where smart people get their news. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
That grapes are one of the most heavily sprayed of all agricultural products? Most people don't. But that is why it's so very important to drink wines that are made with certified organic grapes. And that is exactly what we are inviting you to do today. Taste our wines. We select them personally. They come from small properties in the south of France. They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. And they are earth-friendly. My name is Véronique. I founded the Organic Wine Company in 1980 for people just like you. People who love wine and want to do well by our earth. Call us at 1-888-ECO-WINE. We'll answer all your questions. I look forward to talking with you. Call 1-888-ECO-WINE, and that is ECOWINE.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com. Or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. I have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
I will, thanks.
Trees in the eastern part of North America are on the menu for an insect from Eastern Asia. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. The emerald ash borer somehow traveled from Asia to North America a few years ago, and today it's killing millions of trees in the eastern part of the Great Lakes Basin. The insect was discovered in Michigan 2 years ago, and it recently spread into Ontario, just across the Canadian border near Detroit. Ken Marchant is a forestry specialist with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, and he does not mince words when talking about this insect.
It may be the worst forest pest to ever be introduced to North America. It has built up its populations amazingly quickly, and it's living up to its name as an invasive alien species. The populations build up extremely fast to damaging levels, and it has killed an estimated 7 million trees in southeastern Michigan, and it's infested probably a couple hundred thousand in Ontario.
The insect drills beneath the bark of the ash trees and destroys the vessels that carry water and nutrients up to the leaves and branches. Marchant says the emerald ash borer comes from cold parts of China and Russia, and it's well suited for its new home in North America.
It comes from an area that has a very extreme climate, and it comes over here pre-adapted to the climate. In fact, we'd probably think much of eastern North America was a tropical paradise, and the species of ash in eastern North America are very much to its liking.
Marchant says one of the only ways to control the emerald ash borer is to keep it from spreading. In Ontario, people are cutting down tens of thousands of ash trees, and they're hoping that the insect won't jump across that buffer zone. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
The best of the rest of the news, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Forces of the world unite, let us save the day. Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay. We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard, and we too sometimes need to paint our homes.
And welcome back, workers of the world, bosses of the world. You know, yes, good, that's great. It's from Jim Tur's website, BlueCanyonProductions.com. Some great parodies there. 4 minutes before the hour, coming up on the end of the show here for this Monday, the 22nd of March. And Robert in Clifton, Tennessee is on the line. Hey, Robert, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, Tom. I'm hoping you're having a good day.
I am. What's
I'm
up?
I'm a little off the market here, a little off the topic here, but I'd like to recommend a book by Jerry Z. Muller called The Mind and the Market, Capitalism and Modern European Thought. And because in the past you've mentioned Edmund Burke as a foundation of modern conservatism, the section that he has on Burke is very important, especially since your book also deals with the East India Company. In the book, he says that the East India Company was needed to be regulated by the government. And in fact, although we hear most about his book on Reflections of the Revolution in France, his published speeches and things were mostly about the East India Company and the corruption of the corporation and
Burke's?
How it was undermining.
Edmund Burke's?
Edmund Burke.
Oh, interesting. Well, you know, the East India Company was aggressively, just like modern American, like the largest of our corporations, aggressively was asking for regulation. And that's what the Tea Act of 1773 was all about. And the same way that Monsanto, for example, went to the George Herbert Walker Bush administration before there were any genetically modified organisms on the market and said, we want regulation through FDA, USDA, and the third agency, whatever it is. We want regulation from all three of these agencies for GMOs. And the reason why is because they were going to bring this stuff to market and they wanted to be protected from lawsuits. I mean, if you say that if the regulation says 10 parts per million per billion of arsenic is the maximum and you have less than 10 parts per billion, then you're safe. So, you know, regulation helps some corporations. But it's interesting. Robert, what was the name of the book again, real quickly?
It's Jerry Muller's book, The Mind and the Market.
Mind in the Market. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call, Robert. Thanks for calling. This is Tom Hartman. Thanks to Louise Hartman for producing the show today, Brad Walrod for editing our music. Thanks to Ramesh Schneider for answering the phones and hanging out with us this afternoon. Thanks to our sponsors for participating. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up, and thanks to you for listening this afternoon. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If elected, I'll lie about weapons of mass destruction as a pretext to invade another country.
I'll call myself an environmentalist and gut clean air standards.
Our allies will go from respecting us to hating us, and I don't care.
I'll leave no child behind, unless they can't afford it.
I promise to keep you in a state of fear and anxiety, so you never question what we're doing.
And if you do, we'll call you unpatriotic.
Furthermore.
The war they are in has been declared over by the same man who lied them into it. Their reward? Combat pay cut in half. $1.5 billion cut to their family housing. $20 billion cut to military health care. No health care for reservists.
Lancers, bring them on.
Thousands wounded, hundreds dead, and no end in sight. If we support our troops, why can't Bush? Or is this what they mean when they say an army of one?
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman.